On this week's 51%, we speak with activist and sociologist Betsy Leander Wright about her new book, Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Examining why white Americans increasingly disagree on what falls into those two categories.
They prided themselves on being colorblind and genderblind, like I treat everyone the same.
WAMC's Samantha Simmons also speaks with Rensselaer County District Attorney Mary Pat Donnelly for Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Our main guest today has spent a lot of time asking two basic questions. Is this racist? And is this sexist? It may not surprise you to hear, but white Americans' perception of racism and sexism has changed a lot in the past few decades. Just look at, for example, increased conversation around microaggressions, or on the flip side, the recent attacks on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. President Trump has claimed DEI initiatives are unfair to white people, and that they prevent the quote-unquote best person, which frequently stands for white male, from being chosen for any given job. No pun intended, but 30, 40, even 50 years ago, those two questions of is this racist, is this sexist, were a little more black and white, at least to white people. Activist and sociologist Betsy Leander Wright tries to understand why in her new book called, get this, Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. Leander Wright has written several books on class, race, and economic inequality in the U.S. For this book, she teamed up with sociologist Jesse Strive to interview more than 120 white Americans from all kinds of regional, political, and sexual backgrounds. What they found is that what white people consider racist and sexist is becoming increasingly dependent on their political beliefs.
We obviously had a very huge cultural shift when legal, like racial segregation, was outlawed. And women got so many more rights to hold like bank accounts in our own names, et cetera. The legal barriers got knocked down by the movements of the 60s, 70s, and more recently. So now we're, by and large, we're looking at things that are more cultural, more inside people's hearts and minds, and discriminatory practices and biases that are not in the law. They're what they say, de facto discrimination, not de jure. It's not the law anymore. It's just what happens. So that makes it a more confusing topic. But also, both major political parties and the very conservative and very liberal media have greatly intensified their focus on these two issues of racism and sexism in this century that we're in now. Compared to, it just wasn't as talked about in, say, the 80s, 90s, early O's. So it has been raised up as a banner by the Republican Party saying we no longer have racism and sexism in this country, and the Democratic Party saying we need to get rid of these big inequalities. And media has gotten more partisan. Many fewer people listen to neutral journalism that fact checks. So I think those are the biggest trends that we did find were really affecting the 120 white people that we interviewed.
So tell me a little bit more about the people that you interviewed for this project and what you found.
Yeah, well, we had deliberately wanted them to be varied. So we had some hypotheses, like good social scientists, about who would tend to think differently. And my co-author, Jesse Strive, is a sociologist at Duke University. So she did the Southern interviews. I'm near Boston. I did the Northern interviews. We wanted to see if there were regional differences. We hypothesized that there would be social class differences, that working class people with high school educations and non-professional jobs would see racism and sexism differently than professional managerial college grads. We turned out to be wrong about that, which we're happy about. We debunked some real classist stereotypes there. It's very, very small differences by class. Of course, we're interested in the difference between men and women. We thought there'd be big differences, especially, of course, on sexism between men and women. There aren't. It was really shocking. And there wasn't as big regional difference as we thought either. So really, the big difference is, do you affiliated with one of those political tribes on the left and the right? And not everybody is, but that's the people who hold the strongest opinion. So that was fascinating.
What was the actual interview process like? You know, what exactly were you asking them? And you know, your book lays out kind of like four different categories that people kind of ended up falling into on these subjects.
What we did was we posed more than 20 questions, like fictional scenarios, women and men pay inequity scenario, a white police officer shooting an unarmed black person scenario. We created a whole bunch of those. And then we also asked about things in the news recently, and asked the questions that are the title of the book now over and over again. So, is this racist? Is this sexist? And the 120 something people were split right down the middle of a lot of people who tended to, in just about every scenario, say, no, it's not, unless it's an actual hate crime or explicitly hostile action. They would mostly say, no, it's not racist, it's not sexist. And then about half would almost always say, yes, there's racism in that situation, or that person's being sexist, that fictional or real person. And so that's our two big groups. There's big variation within each of those, which is why you said, yeah, we ended up with four types. And those are four chapters in the book of where are people who give these kind of answers coming from. We really unpack it with a lot of stories and quotes. And so, not surprisingly, within each group, there is the politically motivated partisan people who are angry at the other side. So the red people who watch Fox News and vote for Republicans, they were the most vehement and consistent of the people who are like, no, it's not racist and it's not sexist. And at the other end, or blue people, the people who self-identify as liberal, tend to vote for Democrats, listen to MSNBC, NPR, they just over and over again said yes, and with great vehemence and passion. And those two groups are very angry at each other. But that only was about half of everybody. Most Americans, as we know, are not that political, don't follow politics, and don't consume much media. And so some of the people, I was actually fascinated by the people who tended to say no or tended to say yes, not because of they were affiliated with a political team. So, and I have to say, as somebody on the liberal end of the spectrum myself, I was pretty surprised how impressed I was and how much empathy I felt for the people who said no. They didn't see racism and sexism. And here's just one detail about the more apolitical people who just like, no, I don't see racism, I don't see sexism. First of all, they were more flexible. They sometimes did see it. But they prided themselves on being colorblind and gender blind. Like, I treat everyone the same, which, you know, I'm critical of that opinion because I think it makes you blind to racism and sexism. So I disagree with them quite a bit. But I learned something about so many of them were raised by bigots and haters. So many of them said, yeah, my grandfather used the N-word. You know, my parents told my sister they'd disown her if she had a black boyfriend, or they, and they're like, I resolved to not be like them. I'm going to be the opposite. They discriminate, they look down on people based on color or in gender. I'm going to treat everyone the same. And so I'm going to tune out basically anything that mentions race and gender, and I'm just going to be like, we shouldn't label people. So they were very unaware of the big patterns of racism, sexism we have in the society, but they were coming from this really heartfelt place that I was moved by. They were intentionally being different than who raised them.
Looking at, the different paths of reasoning people were taking when they were navigating these questions, did you see that reasoning change when the subject was racism versus when the subject was sexism, or were they kind of using the same reasoning for both isms?
That's a great question. It differed a little bit. There's a lot more people who are vehemently that we no longer have racism in society. And if you bring it up, it's a liberal conspiracy or it's discriminating against white people. There's more vehemence about that. And some of those people said, yeah, there still is some sexism. But by and large, the people who said no to both. By and large, the bulk of the people who said yes, they see racism, also said they see sexism. And the really mind-blowing thing is that the gender of the interviewee didn't matter that much. It mattered a little bit, but we thought we would see, this fits with how sociologists tend to think, we thought we would see women, white women, these are all white people, white women saying, no, think those scenarios are not racist, but yeah, I see a lot of sexism. They didn't. The conservative women, even if they had been discriminated against, or in some cases had a lot of domestic violence or sexual assault against them, if they said they didn't see racism, they also said, that's not sexism. Anybody can be attacked or anybody can be mistreated at work. That's just bad behavior. There wasn't a single woman who was strongly saying no to racism and yes to sexism. There wasn't even one. And this is about 60 women.
Why is that, do you think? Even in those instances where women may have experienced things like domestic violence or sexual harassment and stuff at work, is it just a certain determined like gender blindness along with color blindness, or are there other things going on?
There are some other things going on that there's an approach they have to these questions. So we were doing this during the heat of the Me Too movement. And so they were very protective of accused people in general. So when we said the example of the white cop shooting a black person, they felt protective that he needed due process, the cop needed due process. It was important to them, like innocent till proven guilty, and that you really ask a lot of questions and dig into a situation. So I'll give you a sexism example. Before you judge, you have to, that was very important to them. You have to ask a lot of questions before judging. One of our scenarios is a man is in a hospital bed, and a woman comes in the door of his hospital room wearing a white coat, and he says, hello, nurse. And she says, I'm your doctor. Is this a situation of sexism? So the liberals, of course, all said, yes, it is. And lots of people could give examples of how women have been presumed to be lower on an occupational ladder, especially the ones who worked in healthcare said, yeah, that happens all the time. What the people who said, no, it's not sexist, did is they asked a lot of questions about things like, was the guy on some kind of meds that clouded his brain? What was the angle of his bed to the door? Could he see clearly? They were coming up with sort of excuses for him. They've kind of had a feeling of like labeling him as sexist, like give the guy a break. He's in the hospital. He's obviously not well. So they tended to side with accused people, whereas the more liberals who said always said yes tended to side with the accuser. And to them, it wasn't about asking questions about the case. You reach the conclusion that yes, it's sexist by going to these big broad patterns in our society of yes, that happens to women, so therefore it's happening in this case. And we think there's strengths and weaknesses in both these approaches. There's something to be kept that the questions about the case are really good practice. But the knowing the broad patterns and bringing them into play and saying, is this an example that you need to put the two of those together to make good judgment calls.
Yeah, how do you see these judgment calls contributing to the environment that we have now and in contributing to things like institutional racism and sexism?
Yeah, so of our four categories, three out of four didn't know much about the disparities, the institutionalized disparities that are built into so many of our systems, racial disparities and gender disparities. The motivated liberals were the only ones that consumed a lot of media. Some of them had studied it in college. So that's definitely important to me, that if we're going to reduce disparities, say, in healthcare, where there are both race and gender differences in who's included in clinical trials and who gets better care and who's believed, if we're going to change healthcare and the wealth gap and criminal justice, we really do need to take that broad view of what tends to go on, what are the patterns in our society. But then we need not to jump to the conclusion that in every case the pattern is playing out. So everybody needs, I think we all need to examine our methods of reaching these conclusions, and we all need to improve them. So yeah, we see the book. The goal of the book is reducing racism and sexism by getting people to be more accurate and more informed about their ways of making calls.
Yeah, tell me more about that. Are there any other recommendations that you guys make in the book?
Yeah, I think we all can get better at civil conversations, learning where other people are coming from. People are not persuaded by anybody who just scolds them, shames them, tells them their facts are wrong. That never works. So we could get more constructive conversations across the red-blue divide. And we could do a good job at identifying and speaking up in the cases where there are gender or race inequities. We use a metaphor for our recommendations, which we call the surveyor method. Like a land surveyor, if you go to a construction site, somebody has that little scope in front of their eyes. And so we say there's three parts. We should all try to be good surveyors. There's three parts to surveying. First, you need to really study the landscape and you need to know geology. This is the metaphor for the institutionalized sexism or racism that you can't always see happening. It's built into the landscape. So you need to know what's going on under the landscape. You need to be very well informed. But then they put down little probes into the particular site. What's happening in this particular piece of ground? So that's asking a lot of questions about the case, gathering evidence. And then the third, and maybe most important, surveyors work with other people to build a strong building. So once we have learned about the patterns of race and gender disparities, once we've investigated, is this particular case an example of it or not? We then collaborate with other people to try to make things fairer in the future. So that's our last chapter in our recommendations. We should all be good surveyors.
Betsy Leander Wright is the co-author with Jesse Strive of Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. It's out now through Stanford University Press. Betsy, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's great talking with you today.
The month of February is Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month. We talk a lot about abuse and domestic violence on this show, from what it looks like and what the early signs are to how to seek help. But the things that adults grapple with in abusive relationships sometimes look different from what teens have to navigate. And the relationships you have in your youth can really set the foundation, good or bad, for what you expect from partners in the future. One way to help teens have healthy relationships when they're older is to teach them how to identify abuse and disrespect at a young age, and what to do if they come across it. Mary Pat Donnelly, the district attorney in New York's Rensselaer County, says she takes this mission very seriously. She spoke with WAMC's Samantha Simmons on the subject. And just a heads up to our listeners, this conversation obviously touches on domestic violence. If you or someone you love has been impacted, you can contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline anytime by calling 1-800-799-SAFE or by texting START to 88788.
As a parent of five children and someone who's taken a vested interest in my role as district attorney to communicate with the high schools and to become aware of the way teens operate nowadays, I've come to learn that dating is not what it was when I was dating. One of the big things is the pool of individuals that young people are exposed to is so much larger. So you don't have parents and aunts and uncles and community members always able to understand who a teen is interacting with. So it shoulders on the teen thereafter to understand their responsibility in keeping themselves safe and, conversely, being a good partner to whomever they are engaged in a relationship with. So respect, I think, is the ground level. Obviously, we want more than just respect, but if we can teach a message of respect in a teen relationship, I think it's a really important starting point to a healthy relationship for a younger person.
Why, as district attorney, is this issue important to you?
Sure. So as I said, I feel like my role as DA obviously encompasses prosecuting crimes that have already been committed and doing my very best to interact with law enforcement and make sure we have justice for our victims. That said, I want to make sure there are less victims. And I am a parent of five children. Four of them are teenagers. One is almost a teenager. And I'm pretty aware of the environment in which today's youth are growing up, the environment in which they're engaging in relationships. A lot of these relationships start in a digital fashion, and it's very easy to be disrespectful when you're not looking at someone face to face. So dating violence is not always going to be a shove and a slap and a punch. It's also going to be emotional abuse and, unfortunately, sexual abuse as well.
Young people aren't always as aware and emotionally intelligent as adults are. So how can kids recognize abuse in relationships outside of an adult mentioning it?
And that's exactly what brings us here today, is trying to put that out in a public fashion, put it on a billboard, put it on social media, to get young people thinking about it. Because when it's your very first relationship, you don't know what to expect. You don't know that if someone is treating you in a disrespectful manner, if that's okay. Maybe you didn't have a relationship at home to model your hopes for. So it's really important that kids understand everyone deserves respect. And even if you've done something maybe deceitful, or you've decided you don't want to date somebody and you don't have a really good reason, that's not an excuse for disrespect, for name calling, for, you know, revenge porn, for all of the awful things that today's youth have to deal with that were never a situation when I was dating 35 years ago or whenever that was.
And abuse isn't limited to romantic relationships, especially as teenagers. Many kids, you know, go through bullying. How can kids protect themselves, and who should they seek help from in these situations?
This is a really tough one, because bullying is such a broad term, but it is so pervasive. And I can point to several specific examples that I've become aware of with the teens that I'm close to. It is very important that a teen have someone trusted to share with, and not everyone has a parent they can share with. They need to be aware of who can help them. So that's what the whole movement is about, is to go onto this really wonderful interactive website that can point you in the right direction. It doesn't just say, call this hotline. It gives you some ideas of who you can trust, and hopefully there'll be someone at school that they can go to, someone who can put them in the right place, because the consequences of bullying are very real and can be very tragic. You know, a student who has support at home is going to suffer just as much as one who doesn't, but one who doesn't is going to have no path out of the downward spiral that bullying can cause. And it goes across all demographics. It doesn't matter, you know, what your socioeconomic background is. All it takes is one peer who decides they want to make trouble for you and a few peers who want to join in. And it can have devastating and long-term consequences.
For friends of teens in abusive relationships, how can they support their friends or family without getting themselves in any sort of trouble or danger?
Be there to listen and seek out a trusted adult. Not everything will go to law enforcement. My personal belief is that it should. It doesn't always have to result in an arrest, but making a record of something that's happened to you can be very helpful down the line. You may not know that that person has hurt someone else. You may not know the big picture. And you have a choice when you go to speak to law enforcement. You can let them know where you're at with this particular situation, especially as a young person under the age of 18. That's my personal belief. But what's most important is that someone feels supported and that they have someone to help them find a path out, because respect is the bottom line, and you should never tolerate disrespect. Even when the person that you are dating or engaging in a relationship with is apologizing and telling you it was a one-off and it will never happen again, disrespect is not going to go away. It's never going to get better than when you first start dating. It's not going to become more respectful. It's not going to become less stressful. And if it's not good at the beginning of a relationship and you're not getting the respect you deserve, you need to get out and you need to find someone who can help you get out.
And of course, adults get into abusive relationships all the time, and I'm sure as DA you've seen the worst of that. But what can young adults do, or what should they be aware of to avoid getting or staying in an abusive relationship?
You want to look at the red flags, and one of the things that you see for in the first instance, again, to go back to the what we started with, is the disrespect. Words are going to start. Emotional abuse is first. Not allowing the person to have their own life, not allowing the person to make decisions for themselves. Where are you? Who are you with? Why are you talking to her? Why are you talking to him? Excessive, possessive type behavior. Even if it's not going to result in ultimate violence, it's not healthy. And that's also part of this movement, is a healthy relationship. Again, just because there's not physical violence doesn't mean there are not unhealthy implications that can be really devastating on a growing person, someone who is not fully developed, who's figuring out who they are, who doesn't have the self-esteem and the inner strength to stand on their own two feet, and who may cling to a relationship. And if that relationship's unhealthy, it's going to have bad consequences going forward.
And are there any other initiatives that the county participates in that can support youth in, you know, whether it's an abusive relationship with parents or friends or other family members?
Rensselaer County has individuals who are in our schools, and they're boots on the ground. They work with the counselors within the schools, and they're very present for the youth within Rensselaer County. The district attorney's office tries to get into the schools at least once a year. We try to keep it focused on criminal type behaviors like fentanyl awareness and drugged driving and drunk driving awareness. But that relationship and that ability to be in the schools and present for the kids has been pretty well received by all the districts. And I think that's helpful in and of itself, just to remind them that there are adults that care. And I've had many kids come up at the end looking for assistance and wanting to share, and we try to point them in the direction of those people that are funded by Rensselaer County that are in the schools.
That was Rensselaer County District Attorney Mary Pat Donnelly speaking with WAMC's Samantha Simmons. If you or someone you love has been impacted by domestic violence, please know help is available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is open 24/7 at 1-800-799-SAFE or by texting START to 88788. The nonprofit Love is Respect has a hotline and resources geared specifically for teens at its website, loveisrespect.org. Thanks to you for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The night air down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.